You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert, sitting in for Celeste Quinn, producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frayne. And that music may sound familiar, particularly this time of year, if you turn on the TV or all around Christmas time, especially in the last 20-plus years. It's hard to imagine a holiday season without It's a Wonderful Life. There was a time when we could find it running three or four times a day on different TV stations during the holiday season. And now it only runs once a year, but it still remains popular on video and in locally based screenings. Today's guest, joining me in the studio, Steve Schaefer, Assistant Dean for the University of Illinois' College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and he's also an Assistant Professor of Cinema Studies at the U of I. Being a fan of It's a Wonderful Life, I sought out someone for a program like this. I did a search on Cinema Studies faculty at the U of I, and lo and behold, I came across Dr. Schaefer. His major interests include 1930s British cinema, films, relationship to society, literature, and politics, and the films of Frank Capra. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
There's so much trivia attached to It's a Wonderful Life, we can't get to all of it, but I really like to focus on the history of the film and the early years, why it wasn't a big success when it was released, and its life after going into the public domain for a while. But first I want to talk about, you met Frank Capra on campus in 1976.
That's correct.
Talk about that experience and what kinds of questions he had from faculty and students and your conversations with him.
Well, in 1976, the Unit for Cinema Studies scheduled a retrospective of Capra's works. And at that time, Capra was circulating among various campuses, universities, to talk with students. And he was kind enough to come to the campus for an entire week. During that time, he visited with students, attended screenings, and also attended dinners and casual gatherings. Capra was an amazing person, and I had admired him and his work for a long time. And when I was invited at that time, I was just in my third year of teaching film, and I know a person who's sophisticated is not supposed to say this, I was thrilled. And so I had the opportunity to have dinner with him. There were about four or five other faculty members at an Urbana restaurant. And then I was also allowed to host one of the screenings in the auditorium. During the time, Mr. Capra was very forthcoming, very open, very casual and pleasant with people. I found especially appealing the fact that he seemed to go out of his way with students and young graduate students who might ask unsophisticated questions. He was very willing to respond to those questions. As a matter of fact, I found that the one quality he didn't seem to enjoy was, pomposity, intellectualizing. And so some of the faculty members in those days, one in particular who's no longer with us, has since passed away, kept asking questions during the dinner. And his body language, his responses all indicated he really didn't like that kind of intellectualizing. But he was very pleasant. He would on two occasions, my wife and I had breakfast at the Union in the old cafeteria we had, and Mr. Capra would come down. His room was upstairs at the Union. He came down and had breakfast, went through with the tray, and was very down to earth, which is in keeping with his own seeming enjoyment of people.
Now, 1976 is at a time that It's a Wonderful Life doesn't nearly have the audience it does today. I mean, this was right about the time when a clerical error, of all things, had led to it falling into the public domain for a while. What did you talk about that film specifically and his hopes that a greater audience would see it?
Well, it's interesting. And that film in the early 1970s, when I was doing my initial film studies, was not one of the films that was usually mentioned when one talked about Frank Capra. When I first started studying films, if you talked about Capra, you talked about Mr. Deeds, you talked about Mr. Smith, you talked about Meet John Doe, It Happened One Night. It's a Wonderful Life was regarded as a minor work and one that was not really worth investigating, regarded as being too sentimental and so forth. I had seen it in the early 1960s, and it had knocked me on the floor. I was overwhelmed by the film. And in the late 1960s, when I first began studying film formally, I would talk about It's a Wonderful Life, and people were very dismissive of it. But by the early 1970s, the film was beginning to get attention on television and was being shown more and more regularly. And as you point out, by 1973 or 74, I think, it fell into public domain, or at least was thought to have fallen into public domain. By that time, people were beginning to catch up with it, and there were articles, there was attention being given to it. And when I, and my recollection of this is not all that firm, but my discussion with Mr. Capra, in which I talked about how much I loved the film how I felt the film was very important, he naturally was very excited to hear that kind of response. And he was forthcoming with details about the film. He had written in his autobiography, which had come out in 1973, The Name Above the Title, which is not entirely reliable in every way, that when he first encountered the story, it struck him as the film he'd always wanted to make. And I think along with Lost Horizon, which had been made in 1937 and which also was a film that on first release didn't have an overwhelming response, or at least the one he expected, I think those were the two films that he regarded as his most important.
The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern. RKO bought it for $10,000, and after he didn't have any success with it, he just put it in Christmas cards, and then the story was purchased and sat on the shelf for a while.
Yes,
and
I think it was originally intended for a Cary Grant vehicle, and there were three screenplays that were worked up, three different renditions of it. One by Mark Connolly, who was famous for The Green Pastures and other stage works. Another one by Dalton Trumbo. And a third one by, of all people, Clifford Odets. And none of these seemed to be going anywhere. Capra had returned from his work in World War II with the Army for the Why We Fight series, and with a couple of other directors had started a company called Liberty Films. And in the process of that, he was looking for a story and found out that RKO had this story, and he instantly went for it.
And, casting was kind of an interesting story as well. He wanted Jimmy Stewart all along,
right,
for this film.
Right.
But some of the other ones, they really struggled with the female lead, with Mary's character. Mm-hmm. They talked about Jean Arthur, Ginger Rogers, Olivia de Havilland, and Donna Reed was not really well known at that time.
That's right. She was an MGM contract player. She had actually come out to Los Angeles in the late 1930s and I think had won some kind of beauty contest at Los Angeles City College, which brought her to the attention of the studios. And in the early 1940s, she was featured in a lot of B-movies made at MGM, Dr. Kildare, I think a Thin Man movie, which wasn't necessarily, that would be sort of an A-minus movie. And but her career hadn't really taken off when Capra cast her as Mary.
Lots of other trivia attached to the film. It was shot for a final budget of $3.2 million. Opened, I believe, in December of 1946.
That's right.
And it was apparently really cold on the East Coast that winter, and a lot of people stayed home, and the film didn't do an awful lot of business.
Well, it was originally intended for a spring release, which is odd because it's a Christmas film, but it had been moved into a slot In late December, for a variety of reasons, one was the print that RKO was going to, or the film that RKO was going to distribute at the time. I think Sinbad the Sailor, a Technicolor extravaganza, had not been completed, so they rushed it into release, and they released it on December 22nd. And December 22nd, if you have a movie that is essentially a Christmas film, you don't want to wait until December 22nd to release it. Because by the time Christmas is over, people aren't all that excited about going to Christmas films. So it did moderate business, but certainly didn't return the amount that they expected. And yet, there is a fallacy, a myth about this, that the film was not successful critically. In fact, the film received fairly good reviews, and of course, the film also received 5 Academy Award nominations, but it wasn't the blockbuster that Capra was hoping for.
It 5 nominations, didn't win one, although right. It won an Oscar for the manufacture of film Snow.
Isn't that hilarious? Yeah, it was a new method, which I I remember reading one account because in the scene where Clarence and George are in the water, I guess the snow, which was made out of a soapy material, stuck to their faces, and they were covered with a kind of a soapy, slimy material. But yes, it made for a more authentic kind of snow. When the film was being shot, it was shot in weather that was in the 80 degrees range. It was during late summer, and those scenes where Jimmy Stewart looks like he's perspiring, he's perspiring because it's pretty warm.
Coming back to closer to the present, do you ever think about if it had not been for a clerical error that allowed anybody to turn on an independent UHF or PBS station for several years? Now, of course, it's only shown once a year on NBC. Do you ever think about what had happened if it hadn't been for that incident?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point because that certainly contributed to the popularity of the film. But I like to think of the release of It's a Wonderful Life and its subsequent popularity as a Capra story in and of itself. Capra's films always centered around a hero who at some point loses his success and the people rally to him. This is a film that Capra felt very strongly about. And I know that in our discussions he was somewhat disappointed that it wasn't more successful. But the people rallied to it in the 1970s and 1980s, and it has become, of course, our American A Christmas Carol. It's certainly the film that everyone needs to see these days to make their Christmases complete. And the remarkable thing about the film, I had the opportunity to make use of the Capra archives out at Wesleyan University in Connecticut a number of years ago, and I read through some of the materials. I was actually doing some research on Lost Horizon, but I couldn't resist looking through some of the scrapbooks that Capra's wife, Lou, kept. And he had an entire file of letters, and the letters that came to him over the years from people who loved It's a Wonderful Life and for whom it meant something were very inspiring in and of themselves. There were letters from convicts, people who were on the verge of suicide, who said that the film made a difference in their lives.
I wonder, one thing I'd brought up too is that you would think that they would continue to add to DVD releases. There's been essentially the same DVD in the last 10, 15 years with 2 bonus features. We're going to hear real quick for a soundbite from Frank Capra. Some of the things you mentioned, I think, segue nicely into this. Here's Frank Capra speaking, 70s or 80s, in an interview.
That there's more to the picture than was written in it. There's more values in the picture than we knew we were playing with. And that we didn't expect. And that's probably the answer to it. That there's more to it than we thought we had.
Frank Capra speaking in an interview that was taken from the DVD release of It's a Wonderful Life that contains a couple of nice bonus features, but you would think that someone would do a commentary speaking on some of the things that you talked about. Obviously, most of the actors are not with us anymore, but have you thought about something like that?
Well, I wish I had the resources to do that. I think it's certainly something that should be done. There are wonderful interviews of Capra. There are certainly transcripts of his speeches. There certainly is information on the alternative endings, the various items that could be in a DVD, and I think it's long overdue. I agree with you.
One thing I want to mention quickly, we weren't able to get this guest on the phone with us, but there's a book out called The Essential It's a Wonderful Life, a Scene-by-Scene Guide to the Classic Film by Michael Willian. That's something you should... fans of the film should check out. There's a lot of nice trivia attached to that.
I agree, and another wonderful book is the book by Janine Basinger, who is the archivist out at Storrs, Connecticut, called the It's a Wonderful Life book, and it includes the screenplay and has some very good items in there. I recommend that book highly also.
Steve Schaefer, a professor of the University of Illinois campus, assistant professor for cinema studies, has been our guest. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed talking about Frank Capra.